invention. The Connection continues.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Hans Einstein once described his father as more of an artist than a scientist. Albert Einstein once said, according to his son, that the highest praise for a good theory was, quote, not that it was exact, but that it was beautiful. This might seem like a punch in the gut to scientists whose life work consists of searching for those precise truths in the roiling mess that is the universe. After all, to discover an exact theory is to have wrestled an elusive law of nature to the ground with your own bare hands. But a new book explains that Einstein wasn't being patronizing or superficial in his fascination with aesthetics. Beauty, in the many forms it can be perceived, is a particular integral part of the creation and understanding of the greatest equations in modern science. Now, we're talking about everything from physics to evolutionary biology to computer science, and everything in an equation from simplicity to reconciliation to balance, well, you tell us. Connection listeners, what are scientists talking about when they say that an equation is beautiful? And what sort of beauty, if any, do you see, could you see, in these unique sequences of letters and numbers? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That has a certain beauty to it, at least I've memorized it. 1-800-423-TALK. You can, of course, join us on our website at theconnection.org. I'm joined in the studio by Graham Farmelo. He is an adjunct professor of physics at Northeastern University. He's responsible for contemporary science at London Science Museum, the editor of a collection of essays called It Must Be Beautiful. It explores many of the greatest equations in science. And we're also joined from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas, by Steve Weinberg. He is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist and author, most recently of a book called Facing Up, Science and Its Cultural Adversaries. Thanks to both of you for being with me.
Good morning.
Graham, let me start with you, because when we're talking about beauty in science, I'm wondering if in your examination of this, you've decided that it's something that really only years of understanding and study could lead you to, or something that at any time, as a student, as a child, could cause you to kick your chair back from your desk and go, I found something. Do you need to be an expert to get what the beauty is?
Well, I think that all of us at some time have clicked on to the beauty of mathematical patterns. Even when you look at something like Pythagoras' theorem, you know, you look at the numbers like 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared or something like that. There's a certain satisfaction in the patterns of the numbers and the logic that binds them together. And I think all of us have appreciated that even at high school. But it is true that the more you get to know mathematics and indeed science, the more you can appreciate that beauty. And it must be beautiful. The idea is to make that beauty available to people who aren't specialists in science.
Steve Weinberg, does the beauty have to be a component in the sort of equation that you want to embrace?
I would say that we're looking for explanations of the way the world is. If we just listed the data and said that's our explanation, people would say, well, that's not a theory, that's just a list of data. The real problem with it would be that it would be ugly. It would have predictive power. Every mass of an elementary particle in our list would be the same mass that would be discovered in any future experiment, but it would be ad hoc. There would be no particular rationale for it. What we're looking for, the whole job description is to find beauty in our picture of nature. That's what we mean by an explanation. And I'd say this, to appreciate the beauty is not just a matter of a life's career. It's a matter of thousands of years of effort. The beauty...
The work that you do is building on the work...
Well, the aesthetic sense that we have developed, the way we tingle to certain kinds of beauty in a physical theory, is not just the result of our own experience, but the experience of generations of scientists who have gradually gotten it beaten into them by nature that certain kinds of beauty are likely to lead to successful theories.
Does it mean then, Graham, that in order for me to understand the beauty in science, in an equation, I'm better able at identifying the ugliness so I can move that aside and say, okay, that's the chaos. That's the that's the blackboard smeared with a jumble of numbers that makes no sense or doesn't really lead us anywhere. And once I take that and put it to one side and look at the simplicity or the elegance of the result of all that work that I can get it? Is that part of the exercise?
Well, I of course agree with Steve Weinberg that the key thing is that scientists who work on these theories, whatever field they're in, I think that they can make a strong case that the best of their theories, and indeed the most beautiful of their equations, have a certain inevitability about them. They're not things you could just tinker with in some way. You can't just change a symbol here or part of a part of the theory's construction. It has a certain inevitability about it, rather like a great sonnet. I mean, if you take one of the great Shakespeare sonnets, you can't just change a word here or there because you change the beauty of the entire construction. And also has a kind of universality to it. In the same way that when you take possession of a great poem, it has a resonance throughout one's being, you might say. And I would argue that, I mean, the first time I first took some sort of possession of Einstein's theory of gravity, I can literally remember where I was thinking, my God, this theory that you can express on the palm of your hand in the form of an equation, this actually talks about the structure of the entire universe. Could talk about the construction of a black hole, God knows how many
years away. What is that theory? Let me write it down.
Einstein's theory of gravity, it has an equation I'd rather not go into because it will sound complicated, but you can write it on the palm of your hand.
Okay, so the key is not, in fact, the structure of the numbers and the letters, the physical expression of the equation. It is the understanding of what that equation represents. Yes. Where you find the beauty, is that right?
Yeah, the theory of gravity is such that when Einstein came across it, he said that it was too beautiful to be wrong. What he meant by that, I think, was that it was based on very few fundamental assumptions, and you can't tinker with any of them without having the theory fall apart in your hands. And it's expressed very beautifully as something that is an expression of perfect balance, a master equation, if you like, Einstein's fundamental equation of what we call general relativity. And you can't change anything in it. I mean, it's just a beautiful thing to behold, at least in my view.
Steve Weinberg, do you have a favorite that you use?
Well, I think I'd like to comment a little bit more about Einstein's equation because it's a good example. I should emphasize it's not the beauty of the equation itself. It's the beauty, as Graham was saying, of the principles, the underlying theory. One of the things that's beautiful about Einstein's theory is that it leads almost inevitability to a particular equation. And it's very different from Newton's picture of gravity. You know, Newton's theory, there's an inverse square law of gravity. Well, it could have been an inverse cube law or an inverse 2.5 power law. Experiment required that it be an inverse square law, but there was no particular rationale for that. If you start with Einstein's general ideas, there's no way that you can avoid an inverse square law in the context where the inverse square law does work. And in that sense, it's that sense in which Einstein's theory is more beautiful than Newton's. Actually, the equation is not more beautiful. If you write them all out in complete detail, there are 14 equations, whereas in Newton's theory, there are 3. It doesn't matter. You don't assess beauty by counting symbols. You don't assess simplicity by judging how much paper the equation takes up. It's the simplicity of the underlying ideas and the extent to which they force the theory to be a certain way, the equation to be a certain way. But, you know, I said almost inevitable. In fact, Einstein's equation is not as inevitable as Einstein thought it was. And in fact, today we have, I think, a somewhat different perspective that Einstein's equation is just the lowest approximation to a much more complicated equation with an infinite number of terms in it, which actually loses its validity when you go to sufficiently short distances of sufficiently high energy. Einstein's theory is what today would be called an effective field theory. It's just an approximation. I think today, I mean, that's one of the remarkable things, is that today any good graduate student understands what is meant by Einstein's equation better than Einstein did. But the equation survives because in a certain realm, particularly in astronomy, where you have very large distances, Einstein equation is just what you need.
Connection listeners, Beauty in Science. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Ipswich, Massachusetts. Rick's calling in. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. Great show, as usual. I finally got through for once. That's unusual. Yes, I'd like to toss in the word elegance as well. Elegant solutions to me are things that just have an aesthetic beauty and a functionality. It can be something as simple as a piece of equipment. If you've got to design something that has to solve a problem and you have all kinds of things in your way, suddenly you have this aha experience and you found an elegant solution.
You're a scientist as well, Rick?
Well, yes, I guess. I took the an odd route to get there. I was not mathematically inclined from very early on, and in fact, somewhat disinclined. And I wound up being an English major in college, a theology major in grad school. And for the past 22 years, I've been doing plasma physics.
Natural progression.
Yeah, well, it's just one of those things. Actually, I think theology and physics run together quite nicely if you push them far enough. But the way I do physics, and right now I'm working on boron nanotubes, of all strange things, the way I do physics is I see it, and I'll see an element of something in my head, the same way I think a musician would hear a chord or a phrase, or an artist would get some idea for a picture. And I think those are worthy analogies. In fact, Michael Faraday worked by analogy most of his life, did some great work. I have good mathematicians I work with and reference to on, you know, necessary occasions, which is frequent, but we almost invariably get to the same place.
There is an article in Graham's new book, It Must Be Beautiful, written by Frank Wilczek of MIT, about the Paul Dirac equation, and listening to you describe this sort of conceptual notion of a theory reminds me of what's written about Paul Dirac, that this came from some kind of, Graham, some kind of pure mathematical route. What are the words that he uses? Experimental logic?
Well, Dirac had a particular view of... we're talking about a subjective concept here, of course, so there's no rigorous statement I think you can make of about beauty that will appease every single scientist. But Dirac had a particular view of beauty in science, which is that the most fundamental thing was mathematical beauty. And he believed and said on many occasions that if you're a mathematician, you understand it immediately, and if you're not, you never understand it. And that's a particularly austere view of science. But he genuinely believed that when you're talking about truly fundamental problems in physics, like the behavior of a fundamental particle or a fundamental interaction, that he believed as a matter of faith almost, and he had an almost quasi-religious sense of this, that they would be described by equations that had fundamental mathematical beauty.
Rick, thanks a lot for your call. Again. We're at 1-800-423-8255. And Connection listeners, this hour we're talking about science and the beauty that can be discovered in the way that scientific minds lead us to the theories that help us understand who we are and where we live. Our telephone number once again, 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guests with me this hour, Graham Farmelow, editor of a new book called It Must Be Beautiful, Great Equations of Modern Science. And joining us also, Steve Weinberg, Nobel Prize-winning physicist for his work on elementary particles. He's also written a book, it's called Facing Up, Science and Its Cultural Adversaries. And we're talking about discovering the beauty in scientific equations. There is a piece, Oliver Morton writes a piece in the collection, Graham, about the Drake equation. Now, this is about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and probably useful for us to look at that one just to get a sense that we're not really just talking about physics here.
Mm-hmm. Or indeed, I would say about beauty in particular, because that equation enforced a kind of discipline on a field that is notorious for its wooliness. In looking for extraterrestrial intelligence, it's a notoriously fluffy kind of subject. And what the Drake equation did was to isolate the key factors that one should think about when talking about the possibility of detecting such an extraterrestrial intelligence.
I was so enchanted by it that I actually wrote it out when I got
there. Really?
There is the, and this is Oliver Morton writing, deciding that Drake decided that the fraction of stars with planets would be F to the power of P. Is that mm-hmm. correct? Is that, did I say that? Mm-hmm. The average number of habitable planets around such stars would be N to the power of E, and the probabilities of life, intelligence, and civilization would be FL. FI and FC, and last of all, average lifetime of technological civilizations would be L. Mm. Packaged all this together, and I thought, that takes a great mind to do something like that.
Well, I mean, the symbols, of course, don't matter. He could have called them anything. What matters is that he'd had the intellectual discipline to stand back from the subject and say, these are the key factors that matter, and we've got to estimate what those factors are. And it's been extremely influential in that field, although, incidentally, there have been some criticisms of that equation, that he hasn't got all the factors exactly right. I'm personally not qualified to judge, but certainly it's a discipline, I think, that's benefited from his intellectual rigour.
Steve Weinberg, in 1992, you wrote an essay called Beautiful Theories, and in that you were talking about the chaos in the universe, the messiness of the genetic code, though I guess in the last 10 years that's been clarified a little bit.
No, not in the sense that I was talking about. It hasn't changed.
Okay, but in the way that we're talking about Drake's creativity and or discipline, I should say, to use Graham's word, is that a large part of how you define what makes scientific work, a scientific equation, beautiful? That it just moves aside all the irrelevant complications and zeroes in on what counts.
Look, I think you're really overdoing this business about beauty. That's the title of the book that Graham Farmerlo edited, but it's not really the subject of the book. The subject of the book is great equations, whether they're beautiful or not. And as Graham hinted, the Drake equation is not particularly beautiful. It just incorporates a common sense of how you multiply probabilities to get together to get the probability of a compound event. In fact, there are lots of places in science where you don't find beauty because the aims are different. For example, the caller called in about plasma physics. Well, a very distinguished plasma physicist, Marshall Rosenbluth, once said to me, if you find a really beautiful theory, very elegant, describing phenomena in plasma physics, it's almost certainly irrelevant to building a controlled thermonuclear reactor. That's a field that's not driven by the search for beautiful explanations, it's driven by the search for usable power from thermonuclear reactions. And in the same way, you mentioned the genetic code, there was a theory when, after the double helix had been discovered, that the way that the cell interprets 64 possible choices of base pairs to generate 20 possible amino acids would be elegant. It would be a way that uses all the information in that choice of one out of 64 triplets of base pairs to produce an amino acid to give you error correction in the code, to not waste any information. In fact, the genetic code is a mess. Anyone today could design a better genetic code. The reason it's a mess is because it hasn't evolved. It hasn't had to evolve. It hasn't evolved very much. And so there have been no evolutionary pressures to make it an efficient code. It just is the way it is because that's the way it's always been. It's illusory to imagine that you're going to find beauty in all of science. Sometimes the problem is that people think that they're looking for fundamental explanations when there isn't any fundamental explanation, like why the planets are the distance they are from the sun. Kepler and others have sought beautiful explanations of why Mercury is a certain fraction of the distance from the sun that the Earth is, and so on. And there isn't any beautiful explanation. It's a historical mess. It's something that arose when the solar system formed about 4.5 billion years ago. It's not something where the search for elegance or beauty is appropriate. That's part of the stock and trade of the scientists, not just to go all a quiver when they think of something beautiful, but to realize when it's appropriate to use beauty as a guide and when it isn't.
We're at 1-800-423-8255, and we're off to Sherborne, Massachusetts. Doug's calling in. Hi, Doug.
Hi. You stole my thunder there, but not quite, because I was going to ask, when is a theory, what's the danger of an ugly theory hanging around that, and it would blind us to the truth? But I'll turn to some of the work that I've done on English orthography, where some scientists, including Noam Chomsky, orthography being the way that you write the language. And Noam Chomsky says it's absolutely beautiful because it's the best of all possible worlds. It's a compromise between the deep structure and the surface structure. And are you there?
Yes.
Okay. And it turns out to be just a historical mess that we've stuck ourselves with because we refuse to reform, and that's why it's so hard to read. And yet people will tell you all the time how beautiful it is. So I thought that might be a good example in the social world of how something beautiful is really wrong-headed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one can be perhaps a bit too literal about this concept of beauty in science. I mean, as I said before, not all scientists would agree on the definition of beauty in their subject. I mean, I'm not a chemist, but I know that people that look at the behavior of the chemical elements and how they combine see a kind of beauty in chemical equations. And one of the ones that's looked at, and it must be beautiful, in fact, the one, are the equations that govern the thinning out of the ozone layer above the Earth, the Molina-Rowland equations. Now, in the eyes of many chemists, that is a beautiful set of equations because it reduces an extremely complicated situation to something which you can actually write down on a small piece of paper, and has given tremendous insight into that subject. Now, that's not the same thing as the detailed, rigorous, mathematical, austere beauty of a fundamental theory in physics, but nonetheless I do think that you can validly argue that it has a beauty of its own that's contiguous, if not the same.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. Doug, thanks very much for your call. And we're next to Springville, New York. Ibrahim is calling in. Hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
I appreciate your show. It's a wonderful show, as usual. I'd like to make a comment. It's not very deep and deep or very sophisticated as your caller or your speakers are. But I am from Arabic descent. And the word for mathematics in Arabic means mental exercise.
What is the word, Ibrahim?
Riyada.
Riyada.
Yeah. And it means mental exercise. I am in humanities now, but I remember in high school when we used to have an equation and there's a certain satisfaction and joy in getting it right. And there's some kind of a beauty in figuring out the problem and ending up with the right answer. Mm. So the word riyada means stimulation of the mind. Almost like an exercise. You feel good after a good workout. You feel good after having a mathematical problem. And it's a recollection from high school and beyond.
Steve Weinberg.
That's all I have.
Well, it's, yes, it is a pleasure to get the right answer when you do a mathematical problem. Unfortunately, nature doesn't present us with neat mathematical problems. In looking at the variety of phenomena in nature, you have to try to figure out what can be reduced to a mathematical problem that can be solved and what can't. I wish it was as easy being a theoretical physicist as it was to be a student of algebra when I was in high school, because there the problems were all guaranteed to be solvable, otherwise the nice professor wouldn't have given them to us. Whereas in physics, most of the time, you spend wasting your time trying to solve problems that are either irrelevant or insoluble.
Why do you say wasting your time?
Well, because you're not getting anywhere. You're not accomplishing anything. The only thing you're doing is keeping yourself active for the rare moment when you actually get something that works.
But aren't you moving irrelevancies off the table in the search for something that works? I mean, isn't that part of the exercise?
Oh, I suppose so, but since there's so many irrelevancy, it doesn't give you much, so many different kinds of irrelevancy, it doesn't give you much of a sense of accomplishment. I think the main thing is just to keep at your desk.
Graham, do you see a link between what Ibrahim was talking about, the aha moment of the 15-year-old algebra student and the high level of the type of equation in the work that you're describing in your book?
Oh yes. From the humble beginnings of a child in high school right up to the level of Steve Weinberg, those moments are wonderful. That's what drives many people on in science, just the sheer pleasure of solving an isolated problem. But that's not... that's at a relatively minor level, shall we say, in the sense of human knowledge, compared with the beauty of the great theories in science. It's given to very, very few of us to be an Einstein, to formulate a theory that has the structural beauty we're talking about. But as I said, that's what drives people onto be science, to perceive in individual moments of epiphany or enjoyment that there is that sense of how can I put it. Pure bliss, if you like, of solving a problem on the way to a bigger problem.
Steve Weinberg, that pure bliss, is that something that you get once or twice in your life as a theoretical physicist?
Oh, maybe four or five times.
How far along are you?
If you're lucky.
Well, that's four or five times more than I've had, incidentally. But, I would say there's an anecdote I'm very fond of. The French poet Paul Valéry said to Einstein when he met him in one wet afternoon in Paris, I think it was 1922, when he said, where do you, how many books do you need to write down all your ideas? And Einstein replied, laid back, well, it's so rare that I have one. And I think by the standards of most of us, Einstein was teeming with ideas for 10, 20 years of his life. But even then, they're relatively rare for the number of bad ideas that he would have come out on the way.
It's sort of chilling, in fact, to look back over your life in science and realize that your creative life in science has occupied about an hour.
May I say that's a bit of an exaggeration in your case, Steve?
Ibrahim, thank you so much for your call. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, to Burlington, Vermont. Mike's calling us. Hello, Mike.
Oh, hi there. I just wanted to bring up an equation that I guess you could write on even the smallest of your hands, and I guess I discovered as something younger than a 15-year-old algebra student, and that is in one of two forms, e to the I pi equals minus 1. I think demonstrating the sheer beauty in mathematics. None of those terms are arbitrary.
Well, could I just cut in? That's a mathematical equation that's very, very, very useful to scientists. And actually, that topped a poll, I think it was 15 years ago, when a group of mathematicians, a few hundred of them, actually had a vote on which was the most beautiful equation. That actually came out number one in the chart. So you picked a good one there.
Yeah, it got my vote. In fact, it's actually in two forms. You have the e to the I pi equals minus 1, which illustrates a number of concepts, or indeed e to the I pi plus 1 equals 0 is the other form, which also brings the concept of null into it.
Mm-hmm. And when people who are not scientists, not mathematicians, not physicists, Mike, listen to your description of that and kind of scratch their heads and go, all right, I get good sculpture. I understand good painting. Where's the beauty or the brilliance in that? How do you answer that?
Well, it actually is something that I've regularly explained to even 7-year-old kids with not necessarily a scientific background. E is the natural number. It's the classic exponent. That's a little harder to explain to kids. I is the square root of minus 1, and pi is the well-known ratio between the diameter and circumference of a circle.
Right.
But as you get, at every layer, I mean, I think I can draw every one of those and explain it to a 7-year-old. But I think at every layer you go down through that equation, you start to see additional beauty. You've introduced the concept of complex numbers, which is where the square root of minus 1 comes in. And, of course, as a practical, actually engineer now, I guess, things like e to the I something or other is very useful in a lot of engineers' lives because it allows us to discuss rotary motion or circular motion as well. So, I think to explain perhaps at least E, it takes a large piece of paper. But other than that, it's pretty simple. And you could probably write that on your thumb, I think, rather than just on your hand.
Mike, thanks for your call.
It's a pleasure.
All right. Bye. Graham, you start by writing a... is it your essay on the Planck-Einstein equation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
And that's one where, and I'm referring back to something that Steve was saying here earlier, where, you know, Max Planck got a piece of it. Mm-hmm. Einstein got a piece of it. Mm-hmm. That it ends up being a collaborative exercise mm-hmm. to watch that theory evolve through different scientists' understanding. So it's not something like a sculptor's finished product where you need to begin with the raw rock and end with the finished product. You can make a contribution along the way.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the equation that you're referring to is E equals HF, is the energy of a photon, particle of light, is equal to a number called Planck's constant multiplied by the frequency of that light. Now, when the great German physicist Max Planck wrote down that equation, arguably the first great equation of the 20th century, he, to be honest, didn't really understand it. Great physicist and a great contribution, but he didn't really understand what it meant. And Einstein, 5 years later, wrote a truly great paper, a paper that Einstein said was his only truly revolutionary contribution to physics. Again, you could argue about that, but it shows how revolutionary it was. And he gave Planck a physics lesson. He corrected several parts of Planck's work and gave us the interpretation that we now believe, namely that it gives the energy of a single photon of light or of radiation. And that equations had the most torturous history, as I set out in that essay. And perhaps one irony there is that Einstein never was happy with quantum theory. He admired it and had a tremendous influence on it, but he never was completely content with quantum theory as a fundamental theory of nature.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, and we're talking about finding the beauty or not finding the beauty in science, theoretical physics, biology, in astrology. I'm going to run out of my list, but you can take that a little bit further as we step away for a break. Once again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at
www.909-9287. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon, and we're talking science this hour. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My guests are Steve Weinberg. He is professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Texas at Austin, winner of the 1979 Nobel Prize in Physics. Also wrote the afterword for Graham Farmelow's book, It Must Be Beautiful, Great Equations of Modern Science. Graham Farmelow is with me in the studio. He's head of science communication at the Science Museum in London. He's also a physicist and teaches that at Northeastern University in Boston. Once again, our number, 1-800-423-8255, to Brookline, Massachusetts, and Kang is joining us. Hello, Kang.
Hi. I would just like to share some of my personal satisfactions in finding the beauty of science.
Give me your favorite one.
Oh, yes, of course. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that when I perceive beauty in science, it comes from a mathematical theory first, and then to a physical approximation, which is like physics. And then finally, we can get to like a practical relevance. And one of my favorite examples is, for instance, Stokes' theorem in vector calculus. It's a very, very simple-looking theorem, and from it you can derive the four Maxwell equations, and from that you can basically have the entire universe that we know in electromagnetism and basically all of modern technology. And I just find that personally very satisfying that that some written on paper could be, you know, you could go into a lab and actually have this thing work for you. And the other comment I wanted to make was about one of the professors earlier mentioned that there's no real reason for the planets being a certain distance apart from the sun. Well, probably, I mean, I would like to suggest that there probably are reasons based on, say, the statistical mechanics of our universe and perhaps the average angular momentum and energy of our solar system. And I think that's probably an interesting problem, though I don't have any time to solve it. And the reason I believe that is I remember back in the day I solved a problem regarding perfect natural gas, a gas.
Steve, I'm going to interrupt you just because you've given us a lot to work with, and I should go back to your first pitch there, the beauty of the Stokes theorem, and ask Steve Weinberg to respond to you on that.
I think the caller may have stated this a little wrongly. Stokes' theorem, of course, doesn't lead to Maxwell's equations. It may be something that you can use in deriving Maxwell's equations from a certain set of assumptions about the way electricity and magnetism behave. But I mean, this underlies a very important point, that you cannot derive the laws of physics from principles of mathematics. There's an additional input called reality. There are lots and lots of ways that we could imagine nature to be, including that there not be electromagnetism at all. And the laws of nature that we know of, like Maxwell's equations, are derived from more fundamental laws of nature. They're not derived from mathematics. Mathematics is the language we use to express them. It's the technique we use for deriving consequences. But mathematics itself is never the explanation of anything. The second point about the caller made another point, which I'd like to comment on, because I think it's a very good one. There are lots of things we can't explain. We can't explain why I have so many hairs on my head and not one or more or one less. We can't explain why the Earth is 93 million miles from the sun and not 95 or 90 million miles. But in that circumstance, we often can find statistical statements that we can explain. We might, for instance, be able to prove as a consequence of the theory of gravitation that there's a certain probability distribution in how far planets are from their central star. So that whereas in any one instance there's nothing to really explain, there's nothing that can be explained, if you find a statistical regularity, then that's something you might be able to explain. Even the number of hairs on my head. One might have a theory about male baldness.
Or lack of male baldness. This is radio. You can have a full head of hair, Steve.
Actually, I have a fair amount of hair left, I'm glad to say. Let the listener imagine my head. But in fact, there are undoubtedly statistical principles that govern the distribution of the number of hairs on people's heads, beautiful explanation, whereas the number of hairs on any individual's head is an absolutely boring fact.
I mean, one of the things that Graham and I were just talking about over the break is biology and how when you talk about or when we discuss the range of science that falls into the category we're trying to talk about. This is one of the hardest ones to grapple with, isn't it, Graham?
Yeah, it is. I mean, one of the pleasures of editing It Must Be Beautiful was learning about things that I knew almost nothing about before, and one of them was about the mathematics of biology. Fundamentally, I think it's fair to say, biology is not a mathematical discipline in the same way that physics is. You take the really great underpinning theory of natural selection. To the best of my knowledge, there was not a single equation when Darwin set out that theory. But mathematicians have brought to it a mathematical rigor that have brought equations into it. Very famously, with the movie A Beautiful Mind, John Nash, the great mathematician, introduced the concept of game theory. And our colleague John Maynard Smith, who's a contributor to It Must Be Beautiful, completely independently rediscovered some of John Nash's results and has brought out various mathematical equations that do evidently apply to nature. And that, to me, is a wondrous thing, that you can look at the messy reality of very, very, very furry things that you can hold in your hand and what have you, and discover mathematical laws, not as fundamental as the one that Steve's been talking about, but that somehow give an underlying appreciation of the way that life behaves.
Do we see that most clearly, perhaps, in genetics, in our, in what the layman understands about genetics?
Well, John Maynard Smith's work is about natural selection and how game theory gives us an insight into how things evolve. So, I mean, as I said, I'm not qualified as a biologist to do that. But another example is example of Robert May's work, where a very simple equation talks about how populations of creatures evolve. For example, fish in a pond. You look at one generation and how the next generation is different and so on. There's a very simple equation there that again, you could, in fact, Robert May's daughter did it at high school. And if you look at it carefully, it has a great mathematical complexity and underlying beauty. So that's another way in which biology has thrown up an equation that has given a great sense of mathematical beauty to those who have beheld it.
1-800.
Yes, both examples come under the general heading of population biology, and it's the branch of biology that physicists love because it can be, it leads to mathematical expressions that are relevant.
I've been much found of out.
much of biology doesn't, and yes. doesn't appeal to physicists so much.
We're at 1-800-423-8255, and we're joined by Harriet, who's calling in from Durham, North Carolina. Hello, Harriet.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yesterday, as a matter of fact, I was speaking with my 3.5-year-old granddaughter, and we were talking about waterfalls, and she noticed that my necklace, my silver necklace, looked like a waterfall to her, which I thought was wonderful. So I told that to my son, who is much more interested in science than I, and he said, well, that's how people learn scientific principles, is by noticing things like that. And I said, that's not science, that's poetry. And his remark was, science is poetry. And I thought that fit in beautifully from a layman's point of view with what you're discussing.
Yeah, well, forgive me if I disagree that science is the same as poetry. I think one the emotional experience of engaging with theories and equations can have a poetic intensity. And as I said before, I think equations are such that they do have a fragile beauty that you associate with, say, a great Shakespeare sonnet. So perhaps, although I don't agree with the identity of science and poetry, I think I see what the caller, Harry, is getting at.
And Steve, what about the juxtaposition of the waterfall and the silver necklace? Go ahead.
I've never understood Keats' line, beauty is truth and truth is beauty. They're related, but they're not the same thing. And you can have beautiful things that are false and true things that aren't beautiful. Beauty is a help. And there are certain similarities between the beauty we have in science and the beauty you have in poetry, but the example of a sonnet is a good one, but on the other hand, when you take rather than a Shakespeare sonnet, a Shakespeare play, they're big, messy creations. Yeah. And most directors leave scenes out or leave speeches out for one reason or another. It doesn't matter. Yeah. The plays, in a way, are wonderful because they mirror the complexity, the lack of beauty of human life. And I think Shakespeare's great tragedies and comedies represent beauty of a higher order, in fact, than his sonnets. And it's a beauty which is very, very different from the beauty of science.
Yeah. May I just cut in there, Steve? Because in Tom Stoppard's screenplay for Enigma, he has a character say that in mathematics, truth is beauty. Do you think there's any truth in that, if I forgive the unintended pun?
Well, I don't know. Mathematicians care a lot about truth, and they don't take the beauty as an example. I mean, there are famous theorems like the theorem about the distribution of prime numbers, of very large prime numbers. They have a very beautiful statement about how many prime numbers you're likely to find if you look at any particular range of very large numbers. And mathematicians are not convinced it's true and have been trying to prove that it's true more than 100 years. So they're not identical. But on the other hand, mathematicians wouldn't bother with mathematicians wouldn't bother with trying to prove it was true if it wasn't beautiful.
We each, several times this hour, move mathematicians to a separate category from scientists in our understanding of the way that their work is to be interpreted, and the work of, I guess it's the work of theoretical physicists. Is that correct, Steve? Is that the distinction we're making here?
Well, mathematics is not part of natural science at all, whether it's theoretical physics. Theoretical physics is the branch of natural science that comes closest to mathematics.
Right.
But whether it's theoretical physics or geology or population biology, none of them are mathematics. Mathematics is not related to the real world. It may be motivated by the real world, but its statements exist by themselves. They just exist because of a logical consistency with certain axiomatic schemes. This is, by the way, an extremely difficult subject in the philosophy of science, to draw a precise dividing line between mathematics, which clearly has something to do with science, and science. Mm. Because mathematics isn't science, but it's something like science. And I have to say that of all the philosophic questions that surround the sciences, this is the one I find most difficult.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. Isn't there a similar problem with looking at the difference between science and technology, where you hear various scientists who say there's a very, very strong dividing line between, and then the next thing you get is a historian pointing out that there are examples where the two are blurred, so to speak. But I would agree with Steve very strongly that it's actually a category error to think that the equations we talk about, and it must be beautiful, are mathematical equations per se. Most important, they serve science. They serve our understanding of the natural world, the universe.
Yes, sometimes when an industry says it's engaging in pure research, it's something like instead of developing a particular toothpaste that tastes good, they consider the general principles that govern the taste of toothpaste.
You guys occasionally leave me in the dust. Along with string theory, Steve, I was going to get you to talk about string theory when you were talking about the relationship between mathematics and science as being extraordinarily difficult. I have real problems with these tiny pieces of string, a millionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a centimeter long as the building blocks of the...
You're not alone.
Are we looking for something... from you on that at some point soon? I guess you are too, huh?
Well, I'm not actively working in string theory anymore. I'm working in cosmology.
Oh, cosmology.
These days.
So you are.
But it's all right. I'm an enthusiast for string theory, and I have worked on it in the past. It's an example where we have bits and pieces of physical theory that don't cohere, don't follow from some underlying principle, but have the kind of mathematical beauty that make us think that there's something good.
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely.
Thanks to both of you for being with me this hour. Graham Farmelow, thank
great
you.
Great pleasure. Thank
Steve
you.
Weinberg, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Graham is editor of a new book called It Must Be Beautiful, Great Equations in Modern Science. Steve Weinberg is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, a contributor to that book, and author most recently of his own, called Facing Up Science and Its Cultural Adversaries. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
For The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.